to thank Cal for organizing this afternoon. It's been a very interesting afternoon for me, and it reminds me that the work I'm going to describe today, which really is a collective, and I was thinking as Ava put her partners up, part of our problem is that we're now over a decade old, and the number of people who have contributed in significant ways numbers in the hundreds, the organizations in the dozens, and so I need to accept that or put that out as a disclaimer. I also need to acknowledge a couple of the previous speakers in that Salvatore's work was a critical inspiration through my colleague Larry Robertson. And Larry is a USDA ARS employee, and really the core of the partnerships I'm going to describe today involves university, government, and nonprofit, and you've heard that theme come up a number of times, how important well-organized farmers are. And for those of you who are young in the audience, let me tell you about one other speaker I was really pleased to see, and that's Julie Dawson. You'll see, someday you'll get old enough to see your former students get up and give a talk like that. It's a great pleasure. Why participatory approaches? I'm a classically trained plant breeding, working in formal systems. I was taught about this pipeline, right? We have a commons of some sort. There's a public sector upstream activity that protects that biodiversity, does some type of enhancement activities, and then somewhere along that pipeline is an interface that crosses over to the private sector. So this was what I thought was supposed to happen, and the reason that we picked up participatory approaches is that for many parts of the world, including many segments of U.S. agriculture, this pipeline really doesn't work that well anymore for any number of reasons, or maybe it never worked that well in the first place. I'm a vegetable breeder, so you're going to find my talk unsatisfying in several ways. For one thing, there's not going to be the type of data you've seen. The data I'm going to present about our successes are really going to focus on commercialized varieties. If a variety is commercialized, we're going to call it good enough in this project. So that is the downstream metric we're using for success. It is also a project that has really been sort of an open source set of thinking. Because instead of this linear type pipeline, I'm going to talk about first what the specific limitations were and then what our response was. So in horticultural crops, we have a lot of species, we have a lot of types and species, we have very limited capacity in the public sector, and that capacity is shrinking. Now, I'm not going to take the time to read all these wordy slides, but they are going to be available online. And one of the problems plant breeders have working this way is we get the varieties out, but we don't take the time to talk or think about how we did that if we're working in unusual ways. And so I've tried to capture some of that in this text, and I'm actually looking forward in the year ahead to having more time to capturing some of the scholarship that is here and we've heard in some previous speakers. So in the U.S., as much as we still do have public plant breeders, and many of us do produce varieties, in the horticultural crops, that pipeline is actually frayed to a pretty significant degree. And there are various peculiar disconnects I won't take the time to go into that mean it can be extremely difficult to get an improved variety to commercialization. For example, it took me 10 years to get my first commercial license through university technology transfer. And I want to make this last point because you've heard a lot about participatory approaches with respect to genetic conservation. I'm going to tell you about some stories we're very, very proud of with respect to variety development and selection. I am not going to be able to tell you the same happy story with respect to genetic conservation in the U.S. And I want to underscore that point as a continuing concern of mine in every role I play with respect to support of ex situ germplasm collections. So in contrast to that pipeline model, we moved for various reasons to thinking about networks. And it's a very obvious strategy. It's a strategy that's been used all over the world. And what we did really was, in a sense, import it back to the US because horticultural crops are relatively underserved. And as we got into this, we discovered some more underserved markets that were important. So as we think about networks focused on variety development and germplasm distribution outside that pipeline model, we look to see that germplasm providers and those who are setting the objectives of our improvement programs really came from all sectors. So in that perfect pipeline model, we have perfect knowledge of our markets and are working in some seamless, prescient way towards perfect outcomes. And I can tell you it hasn't worked like that for me. I don't know about the rest of you. And so it turned out first it was initially very, very important for me to get to know my seed companies really well. But wherever my seed companies were not serving a market, I had a blind spot. And so that's where I had to go directly to farmers. I need to underline again the importance that nonprofit organizations have played in our work outside of extension, because our extension in the horticultural crops in the U.S. is also pretty limited. In the stories I'm going to tell you, breeders and trialers come from all sectors, not just the public sector. And so we have commercial breeders, of course, but we also have individuals who are involved in germplasm evaluation and selection. And I'm going to talk to you about a whole array of different trialing intensities. One important point that really hasn't come up explicitly to the degree that it was important to us in this program is the management of intellectual property. Because universities care about that, seed companies care about that, and increasingly farmer breeders care about protection of their intellectual property. And so we had to deal with the management of that as we began to work in networks. And I don't have time to tell you that whole story, but it's really very interesting. So the first formal commitment we made out of my program, and again, heavily partnered, was something called the Public Seed Initiative, which began in 2001 with USDA support, and as many as partners as we have one sponsor, and it's USDA for all these different projects I'm going to tell you about. The Public Seed Initiative was an outreach component of a large so-called IFAS grant. These were large sort of multifunctional grants, and ours happened to be in genomics, but this was our outreach piece. And it was a recognition that working through traditional seed companies, my traditional commercial partners, by 2001, consolidation in that industry had so constrained the ability of those companies to deliver to markets, particularly in places like the Northeast U.S. and in some vegetable types, that we really were unable to deliver the benefits of public investment in us uniformly across our stakeholders. And so this was really our first attempt at participatory trialing, and it was only trialing in this project. We had a number of successes, and in a sense, the ease of those successes made it clear there was really an untapped potential here. One success was a melon called Hannah's Choice. That's Hannah on my back. And so this was a melon we knew was terrific from the time Hannah was a little child. She's a junior in college now. So this trialing allowed us to open access through smaller seed companies we literally hadn't heard of in the Northeast because we were working with a set of familiar partners. So Hannah's Choice came out in 2004. Hannah was in high school. It's still a very, very nice eating melon. We've discovered some disease susceptibilities, but it's still a good niche market. Keeps less than 6 weeks, so if you're planning to ship it around the world, it's not the best, but if you're planning to ship it from Pennsylvania, it's a great melon. This was another example of something we had on the shelf, again, commercialized through a company I literally hadn't heard of, another Northeast U.S. seed company, when we began this work. So the participatory trialing, and I'm sorry I don't have the time to go into the details of how we did it. It was generally informal, though, to relate back to our discussion of mother-baby trials. The participatory trialing really allowed companies to learn about who we were that we hadn't historically worked with, and they could see materials that the largest companies couldn't afford to distribute. So based on that success, we became much more sensitive as plant breeders to underserved markets, recognizing that we had this handhold with seed companies and without entities that serve those markets, we weren't delivering. Probably the most notable underserved market we spotted in the first part of the 2000s in the Northeast U.S., or maybe the U.S. as a whole, was organic agriculture. At this time, we had no organically managed research ground. Through our participatory trialing, we had begun to grow varieties bred under conventional circumstances in organic grounds. And Hannah's Choice happens to be a variety that performs extremely well in organically managed production systems. Why? We still don't know. And so we had found a few hits, kind of crossovers, that we didn't understand. So we picked up two more large projects, the Organic Seed Partnership, awarded in 2004, and a very important SARE grant more focused on the Northeast, about that same time, where we added to the trialing selection and breeding. And so I'm not going to take the time to go through this slide, but basically when I wrote this grant, I sat down and wrote a manifesto as a plant breeder about this networked approach, recognizing explicitly various types of linkages that we typically do not formally acknowledge. For example, breeder-to-farmer linkages that have been very important in our public seed initiative, breeder-to-breeder linkages. Now, this happens informally all the time, particularly in our case, one-way transfers from public to private. But this opened up a great partnership with our federal colleagues, who obviously are critical in germplasm conservation, but also, of course, are a tremendous repository of strength in public sector plant breeding, and also many different kinds of players, particularly connected to nonprofits. Trialing networks, nonprofits were critical in setting this up. And I just want to show you the scale of this project. We had regional trialing hubs in the Northwest US, in California, New Mexico, in the Deep South, based in at Alcorn State in Mississippi, in the Southeast, in the Midwest, and New York and the Northeast. 90 farmer trialers, 20 doing selection in the first year we had this going, more each year. And then the other last piece that was very important to us, and this really reflects some of the other talks you've seen where usage is involved, is breeder to seed company linkages. Because as much as the seed industry has globalized, in the gaps left in that consolidation process, many smaller companies are popping up where they can take off the shelf public bred varieties and market them at a much lower cost. So essentially the public sector is serving as their R&D department. This just shows the kind of constellation of partners and locations, companies. I encourage you to visit that website to see who all has been involved. And this just summarizes formally what the objectives of that Organic Seed Partnership grant was. And I'm going to focus in on number two for the rest of this talk, looking at the strategies we use to enhance capacity of organic growers to select and to breed their varieties adapted to organic production systems. And the other piece, and I don't have time to talk about this today, was that, and this is still a big issue for organic agriculture, is the availability of seed that's organically produced. So as you've heard in some of the other projects, a critical part, and this again was really just borrowed directly from other large participatory projects, is the objective setting exercise itself. We undertook really a very formal process, one that we certainly have also benefited from in our conventional breeding efforts, and convened some roundtables throughout the Northeast where we had the SARE funding, growers, seed companies, and colleagues from the public sector, and both federal and state. We learned a lot in those roundtables, and you've heard some of the comments from others who are leading these types of projects about how you balance priorities and set a sort of optimal bunch of targets. This is an example of a variety that came out of that process. We had been working for a very long time with the California Pepper Commission. We had cucumber mosaic virus resistance thanks to that long effort based in California. Turned out our growers in New York State had the same problem. This is Liz Henderson on her farm called Peacework. She's a very influential organic farmer. And last year, 2009, we published a variety release with Liz and her colleagues as co-authors, naming Peacework Pepper. It's an open-pollinated pepper with high degrees of CMV resistance taken from the California work, adapted for organic production in the Northeast. So there's Peacework, again, successfully commercialized through a company called Fedco. Another pepper that came out of that, big, blocky, nice red pepper, is King Crimson. Another success out of that project is a cucumber that came from an heirloom variety called Boothby's Blonde. It's a little fat, short, white thing with black spines. Susceptible to everything, but some people value it for its flavor. We had been breeding cucumbers, thanks to my predecessor, Henry Munger, for decades and decades. We made the cross and have actually three varieties that have been successfully commercialized out of that. A variety called Platinum, a variety called Silver Slicer, and Salt and Pepper just won the MGA Green Thumb Award for this coming year. Again, these were approaches that were undertaken without the same kind of intensive data collection that you'll see in some agronomic crops, but really with a lot of dialogue with farmer breeders and those of us who were in a position to handle these more formally. I want to mention another project that came out of a collaborating university, Oregon State. We were very fortunate to engage Jim Myers at Oregon State very early in this. Jim had been working with open-pollinated broccoli populations that had been viewed as not so interesting by the large commercial seed sector. Jim was able to continue a selection program that he had been involved with along with USDA and has been able to successfully commercialize a variety out of that. And then another example was this melon farmer's daughter. Again, an unusual, it was an heirloom melon that you couldn't grow, basically. Put some disease resistance into it, and now it's we're finding that it's found a place in the market as well. So, I want to just take a minute and summarize. There's a lot of output from this, and we were very fortunate about 5 or 6 years ago to catch the attention of a social scientist named Ruth Mendham, who was looking for a focus for her PhD thesis at Penn State. And she picked the Organic Seed Partnership as a focus for her dissertation research. So we were all human subjects, and we learned a tremendous amount being the object of her studies. We asked her why this worked, in her opinion, and she gave us some characteristics of our farmer partners that she thought were especially important, and also characterized how our response to those characteristics had allowed us to move forward in a space that had previously been very contentious. She pointed out that many of our farmer partners were early adopters and brought with them a set of commitments that, in addition to the usual things an agricultural producer brings forward, they need a crop, they need a market, these producers hold certain values. And notably, they taught us to think much more carefully about systems and about synergies. These were producers very interested in optimizing a whole system as opposed to maximizing a particular outcome. And that turns out to be really significant for our work in lots of ways. They're very pragmatic people, making very practical choices, which allowed us to find ways forward that were very practical. We didn't have to have the large philosophical discussions. We could decide what type of cucumber did they want and how are we going to get it. They were very committed, but they were not just committed to their economic success, but to a vision of agriculture as a form of planetary care, where profit was not the only motivator, nor was yield the only motivator. And I'll tell you, for a plant breeder like me who was taught yield, 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 that's all that matters, this was pretty disorienting. And this community often believes in irreversibility. There's a real skepticism about technology and incremental advances. And again, that's been an insight I don't have time to elaborate on, but it's been important for us in lots of our work. I'm just going to show you some pictures of various farmer breeders who have not only contributed to selection, but in some cases have actually identified varieties. I want to just take a minute, too, to highlight that we made a formal attempt that was, I think, very meaningful to many of us to reach out to institutions where organic agriculture was not established, in states where even discussion about this type of innovation was potentially very controversial. On the left, you see the first ever field day on sustainable vegetable production that was held in Mississippi in January 2007 with our collaborators at Alcorn and Mississippi State University. We worked with New Mexico State Universities, with tribal populations across New Mexico, and in Appalachia as well with West Virginia State. This slide reminds me to say that there are also areas where this type of work was really quite well developed. For example, that's a beautiful tomato, Crimson Sprinter, that was improved by David Padell in a wonderful set of activities in North Dakota. Very abiotic stress tolerant, a terrific tomato. Our network of trialing and selection allowed this tomato to get distributed very fast, changed to the extent that it needed to be adapted, but also that abiotic stress tolerance has proven to be very helpful in a number of derivative lines. So farmer breeders themselves, such as David Podell and others, are now actually being used as a marketing tool with some of these vegetable seed companies. So in conclusion, I want to just point out both some outputs of this project and outcomes. So we received a wide array of donated germplasm. Germplasm from my particular breeding program and many other public sector plant breeders working in these same crops, from the USDA Ag Research Service colleagues, from companies who, especially smaller companies, cannot possibly afford to maintain these kinds of trialing networks. And so we had donations of varieties into the trialing network with retention of their intellectual property rights. So we had this network of trialing with donated seed. Out of that has come a lot of diversity we can't quantify. That's a flaw of the way we've worked in this open source way. But also some active licenses, 11 to date. And we're actually working to segregate the revenue from those licenses for this collective. So this money doesn't just go into the typical hopper it would managed by Cornell University, where much of this material originated, or whichever university. The members have agreed to pool this revenue and reinvest. We'll see how that holds up through time, but that's the commitment we are working very hard to maintain. We have additional material in an array of other crops. We've had many outreach events, and again, I have not had time in this talk to focus on the commitment we had also to producing commercial grade seed of these varieties, but that turned out to be another missing link that was very, very important. And part of this project was a mobile seed processing unit that has been run through the Northeast for about 5 years now. And the Organic Seed Partnership website continues to serve as a resource with hits by stakeholders now in over 80 countries around the world. As far as outcomes go, clearly that pipeline paradigm, as powerful as it is and as important as it is in the formal sector, in our case, has been augmented by a much more networked way of working with linkages that have turned out to be pivotally important in some of those outputs. While I don't have data regarding, for example, to show how much better some of these varieties are than perhaps the standards, we do have some really interesting survey data. And again, we were looking for commercialization as the bar. One of our nonprofit partners, NOFA New York, who's been a core partner from the very beginning, took a comprehensive survey. And I need to acknowledge particularly Elizabeth Dick's work in this area. NOFA survey responders, 88% of those who responded to the survey, which was a large percentage, much more than, I don't remember the exact number, but it was a high number, found the activity useful. They identified new winter varieties for their farms, and 79% were more likely to try new varieties. So this speaks to Ava's point about willingness to change. 30% identified whole new seed companies to work with. So in a sense, it was a good marketing opportunity for smaller seed companies. We did see demonstrable increases by this survey in the capacity for growers to breed varieties and in some cases also to produce seed. So 55% of survey responders indicated their seed production and their seed saving ability had improved. So the needs of an emerging, still underserved agricultural community, that is organic agriculture in the U.S., are now being addressed, still anchored in the land-grant university system and its federal partners, but amplified now in a whole array of linkages that are now relatively formalized, thanks to this reasonably long-term commitment. When we asked, again, those who studied us why this project was successful, Ruth said, "We asked, which we often don't do enough of as plant breeders, we listened carefully, and we were respectful of this next point, which is that there was a long-standing gap between organic agriculture and land grants." And you could read, I think, any of the projects you've seen today are bridging some type of gap like this. And because we could focus on short-term goals that were agreeable, we could step over some of these long-term concerns. We had an open program design, which is why I don't have the kinds of performance data you would probably like me to have, but that flexibility allowed for more inclusivity and therefore more productivity, and farmers could opt in or out depending on their degree of commitment. It's really, as I mentioned, it's exciting to see a former student get up and talk about her work continuing in this area. This is a grant that was just awarded by the National Institute for Food and Agriculture last year to a series of partners, including Jim Myers, my former student Michael Mazurek, who took the program at Cornell, colleagues at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and of course the ARS. So you'll see more work coming out of the Northern Organic Vegetable Improvement Collaborative. And the last point on this slide is an important one. We, in the past, were unable to get support to train students in these ways of working. I was fortunate to be able to recruit students with fellowships who made very important contributions to this and are actually continuing in a whole array of ways that radiate out from here. But this is the first grant that's actually providing support for student training. And one more project that I don't have a slide for is two of my students, both of whom visited the network, or a network that's related to some of the work Ava described for a tomato project in West Africa. One with an undergraduate degree from Yale, the other with an undergraduate degree from Harvard, both NSF graduate fellows, are now starting a software company called Ag Squared, meant to serve this community as a way to use information technology to link growers, their practices, to providers of services and markets. So keep your eye on an emerging startup called Ag Squared, and I'm really pleased to be able to tell you about this project. And I think with that, I've only put up the logos of the core contributors or the original partners of the Organic Seed Partnership. But again, I need to acknowledge the literally hundreds and hundreds of people who have joined together to set up this alternative way of providing genetic diversity and a whole host of new varieties to organic agriculture in the U.S. Thank you.
Molly, for a great summary, and it's good to end with success. Thank you for that. If you have any questions, we have a little time for discussion now, so we can do that. Okay, you really did a good job this time. I got it all this time. Yeah, thank you. Maybe a time for a little commercial message. Ava and Salvatore have published a book on participatory plant breeding, right? And that's pretty neat. Oh, here's
a gift.
Plant breeding and farmer participation. That's heavy, heavy stuff.
I'm a few more coffees than three.
Okay. I have another commercial message. You know, one of our valued members of Crop Science Society was Ben Scoveman, who did some really interesting work on participatory breeding of triticale in Mexico some years back. And I want to just say that We have him. He's been memorialized in The Viking and the Wheat Field by Susan Dworkin, who wrote this nice book about Ben Skovman and about the issues of genetic resources in relation to some of the issues about biotechnology, about things like that. So, Susan, thank you for being here, and we really appreciate that effort you made to help us with our genetic resources information. Any other comments or questions we'd like to have? Sylvia, please.
Yeah.
Oh, can I say one thing?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, we had some financial support for this symposium from NEFA, from the USDA. They're providing a small grant, and a couple of faculty members at the Missouri Botanical Garden have made some donations to our getting this symposium off the ground. And one thing we're kind of hoping to do and planning to do is to get a published volume out of this talk plus some other invited contributions to kind of set the stage, the next stage for the participatory activity. So.
Well, before we close in, please, I would like all of you to join me in thanking Carl and all the presenters for the wonderful job they did.